What's up, Claim a Stories fam? We have incredible news to share. A few weeks ago, Season 2 debuted as the number one career podcast in the United States. Thank you so much for your support and for being dedicated listeners.
I went to Japan and I had no leads. I literally had no hookup or no plug into Nike. Mm-hmm. I would bring a couple of issues of the Vader with me and I'd walk into a sneaker store in Japan, can't speak Japanese, and I'd be like, I make this magazine. How do you get Nike? And they'd be like, huh? Who gets you Nikes? And they'd give me a business card. And then it'd be their sales rep. It'd be like their low-level Eakin sales rep. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then so I'd go to that guy and I'd call him up and I'd be like, who's your boss? And then he would give me a manager. And I would just keep building up. I was there for like 2 weeks. And I eventually made my way up to the dude who determined which store in Japan got which crazy shoe and which limited edition number that they would get. Huh.
This is Claim a Stories, a show about leading and emerging BIPOC creatives and how they were able to claim their dream careers. Tell me where you wanna go, where you wanna be. I can help you claim a seat, get you on your feet. I'm Bima, and on today's show, we talk to Jeff Staple, a creative director and streetwear OG whose love of New York City took him all over the world. Growing up as one of few minorities in New Jersey, Jeff fell in love with two things, New York City and hip-hop. Though many know Jeff as the creator of the Nike Staple Pigeon Dunk SB, his impact on the streetwear, sneaker, and design communities far exceeds just one sneaker drop. In fact, he has his own creative agency called Reed Art Department, a streetwear label called Staple Pigeon, and he's the host of an extremely popular Business of Hype podcast. But Jeff didn't always have it together, nor was anything handed to him. During his years as a student, he really struggled to stay engaged in school. He would rather go to concerts to see Mos Def or sneak into Parsons at night to screen print t-shirts. Unable to meet his parents' expectations, he would become a two-time college dropout. As an Asian American, Jeff has dealt with relentless bullying and hate just because he's Chinese. When he was younger, he recalls being ashamed and embarrassed of his own culture. There were times where he would even try to hide it. In our conversation ahead, Jeff shares stories about his experience as an immigrant living on the East Coast.
It was very homogenous, let's say. Mm. And, I grew up in, I was born in Jersey. I'm Chinese by ethnicity, and my parents are, my dad is born in Guangzhou, China. My mom was born in Hong Kong. And, American dream they came with, she was pregnant and they flew here, which a lot of immigrants did. They flew here to have their first American citizen. You know what I mean? Like, that was the goal. If you come here, you immigrate here, and then you drop a baby here, that baby automatically becomes naturalized as an American citizen. Gotcha. And then it makes it much better for the parents to be able to get their passports too, which is exactly what happened. So I was the first American in my whole clan, let's say, and they settled in New Jersey because there was already some family here. And I grew up just like in a very homogenized Caucasian society, like not for nothing, but like if I could give you like a quick stat. There was like 1,600 kids in my high school, and there was three Asians. Among 1,600, and definitely less than 10 black people.
Jeez, man.
1,600 kids.
What is that like? Is it just automatic because it's three of you, you're getting picked on?
Yeah, for sure. Racial ridicule was an everyday experience from birth to 18, and the thing is really interesting is, and this is what they mean by like institutionalization, is like, if you don't know any other reality besides that is your reality. There's actually nothing wrong with it because it's all
that's all you get accustomed to that type of treatment and you're like, well, this is just what happens.
So I remember vividly, like one time we went on a class trip to we went to Canada, I remember. And, they put me and the black kid in a room together, like, because we were the only two in whites. It was like the miscellaneous folder. Like, they didn't know what to do with us.
They're like, yeah. They'd be like, they'll room. Handle each other.
Yeah, we were really broke down. But yeah, that it's just, it was crazy. And you know, I'm not going to say, like, you know, when I say racial ridicule and sort of bullying, you know, there's degrees to that. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, I watched documentaries and, like, granted, no one was burning a cross on my lawn. Mm-hmm. No, you know, like, the shit that's going down right now with Asian Americans and like straight up murder and assaults and stuff like that. And of course, the stuff that is going down with Black Lives Matter movement, you know, like, I wasn't victim to any of that stuff. But it was sort of equally, you know, rough, because it was 18 years of, like, small jabs every day for 18 years.
Yeah.
I don't know which is better, to be honest. I don't know if it's better to just get one big assault. Mm-hmm. One out the way and you're done. Mm-hmm. And you get, like, a cause behind you, or just silent abuse for 18 years every day. You know what I mean?
What is it, like, do you feel like there's a psychological effect to that? Like, what, how did you internalize that? How did that show up in your life?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it puts a chip on your shoulder that, you know, is still on me today. You know, I'm now 46 years old, and I still remember those moments, like, vividly. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I remember, like, lines that kids would say. Like, I remember the very creative, like, bullying words that they would say to this day. You know what I mean? And it's crazy, because, like, you know, there's so much going on in my head, but for me to remember, like, you know, some made up racial slur that some kid would make.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, I guess defensively, I say it's really funny. I was going to say it's really funny. And that's, I realize that's a defensive mechanism for me to be like, try to make light of it, you know, but it's not funny, you know. And, you know, when Trump said, like, Kung Flu, you know, the Kung Flu and stuff like that, like, those little, like, to some people, that's maybe kind of funny. Like, oh, yeah, Kung Flu, it's kind of funny. But, like, no, these things jab.
These are the micro jabs. The micro,
yeah, micro jabs. And the problem is, some people take those things and pour gasoline on them and make them really big things. Like, they take those things to heart, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so it's something that puts a chip on my shoulder. And I realized that when I went to college, you know, which thankfully was in NYU, it was the first college that I went to. It was like just pulling the wool over my head, like just pulling it off, you know, like the wool cap came off my head, and I was like, holy cow, like NYU was like 46% Asian, you know, so it was like all of a sudden it was like my peoples.
Your peoples were there. What did your parents do for work? Did, like, was that in Jersey? Was it in Manhattan?
No, they luckily worked in New York City. They worked in Chinatown.
Okay.
You know, as I mentioned, they were immigrants. And, you know, if you think about it, back in the day, when you go to a Chinese restaurant, you know, there'd be, like, fortune cookies and, like, the little duck sauce and, like, the chips and stuff. Mm-hmm. And the almond cookie that you get for dessert. Someone has to bring all that in from China.
Mm.
That's what they did. They brought in the soy sauce, the fortune cookies and stuff, and they were a distributor to restaurants. So they would get, you know, like a carton full of fortune cookies, bring it into Chinatown, and then distribute them to all the local Chinese restaurants. That's what they did.
Come on, man. So, like, were you, like, did you, like, get any exposure to that? Or you were, that was kind of like, that was what they were doing, and then you were just back in Jersey?
Nah, man. I mean, part of the whole thing about growing up in Jersey for me was a massive identity crisis of being straight up ashamed. And I don't use that word lightly, like being embarrassed and ashamed of who I was because of the ridicule. So when I would come home from school and my house would smell like Chinese food, and my family would be screaming at each other in Chinese, and there'd be a Buddha at the front, and, like, there'd be burning incense. All these things that I find to be, like, beautiful about my culture today were, like, I was so lividly embarrassed about it. I'd be like, why do you have to leave the Buddha out?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, like, today, like, what? You have a Buddha in your front house? That's dope.
Right, right. Like, it's a different different type of time, different age, like all of that stuff. Because yeah. I think, you know, we had an interview last year with Purvi Patel, and she, you know, her family's from India, and she would kind of have this thing where, you know, some of their food, and she would potentially try to hide her clothes because she didn't want the smells in her clothes when she went to school because she didn't want the kids to say anything.
Yep.
It's so crazy. And now she's like, nah, I'm trying to like amp it up.
Yeah, it's such a weird like shift in identity. And so I was really embarrassed about it. I was not trying to be part of the family business, mm-hmm. not even trying to admit to my friends what my parents did. You know, yeah. It's like really embarrassing. So I want to know part of it for sure. The good thing about it, though, was that oftentimes, especially during summer break and stuff, you know, I would have to go to work with them, you know, just because there was no daycare or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So I would just sit in the warehouse, you know, in Chinatown in New York City, which is in downtown New York. And at a very early age, like at 12 or 13, my parents would just say like, hey, why don't you just go walk around New York and come back by 5 p.m. when we leave.
Wait a minute.
I would just walk downtown New York City, like the Village, Soho, when it was pretty grimy, mm-hmm. and just absorb New York City as like a 12, 13 year old and everything that came along with it. So that was the upside of my parents working in Chinatown.
Which is crazy because like you mentioned it being grimy, but like that's their like late 80s, early 90s, right? Like yep. Stuff is going down. In New York, like, were you ever nervous? Like what was your day to day like kind of exploring the streets?
I wasn't nervous because it was just out of, you know, naivete, just like stupidity. I wasn't scared. I was just very wide open. And you could imagine a kid who grew up first 13 years of their lives in like Wonder Bread, New Jersey, mm-hmm. you know, and then you're in the Village where there's like, you know, that saying like selling tapes out the back of my trunk, like mm-hmm. that's not like a fake thing. Like people used to sell mixtapes out the back of their trunk car. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And that's the birthplace of that stuff. That's where that happened. And, you know, people doing like the 3-card Monty, you know, yep. like where like yep. the card games trying
you see
to hustle
it in the
you
movie.
And
right,
stuff.
Right.
and, you know, that really like sort of kitschy scene of like someone with a boombox on their shoulders. Hmm. And like that whole Jamel Shabazz like Pinterest mood board, that was what New York City looked like back in the day. Graffiti, they couldn't stop graffiti. Graffiti was everywhere.
Wow.
You know, selling mixtapes. It's just so dope. And yeah, that was what I was absorbing. Like I got mugged a couple times as a youngin.
You got
mugged. Yeah, I got mugged. I got stabbed, but like not. It didn't puncture me, but like I got stabbed up by MSG. Yeah, at the Pennsylvania Hotel. But these are all just learning lessons. These are all great things. Like I'm all for like people getting smacked down every once in a while. Mm-hmm. You see young folks today and just they act a fool. And sometimes I'm just like, someone needs to like just smack you really hard.
Reality.
So that you know that there's repercussions to things that you do and say. That's the problem with society today, mm-hmm. is like there's no repercussions. You know what I mean?
Nah, it's just like, you know, there's kind of like this untouchable sense like that. And I think that's kind of what happens with digital world too, is just like, you know, I could say, you know, something to you online and I may never see you in person, right? And so it's like,
yeah.
I kind of feel like this sense of, you know, superpower, if you will. It's just what is Jeff going to do? But I know I agree with you. It's like we need, you know, more of that energy. And it's kind of crazy. Like that's what you grew up in. It's just a different time. We'd even, you know, joke about the NBA. It's a different time in sports because things are
more physical. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Louisiana. So down in Baton Rouge, just outside of New Orleans.
Okay.
And it was... You know, there was a lot of areas that were, there was a lot of interesting things going down. So it was not as rough as like what's happening in New York, especially not during that time with some of the drugs and the violence and things like that. But we definitely had a lot of that. I mean, I would just grow up and go to school and just gang fights, just 30 people just fighting in cafeteria. And it's just such a strange thing.
Now it's Twitter beef instead.
Twitter fingers, you know. what were you into as a kid? If you're like you're roaming the streets of New York and you're soaking up all this culture, some good, some bad, but you know, overall, it's just reality of the situation. Like, what started to grab your interest?
Two words: hip hop.
That was.
I mean, like the you know, you talk about the four elements, right? Like DJing, MCing. You know, graffiti, like, wait, what did I miss one? DJ, MC, graffiti, and b-boying.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you walk between 8th Street, East Village, to 14th Street, Union Square, and you are tripping over all four elements of hip-hop culture. Literally, you know? And so that was just, for whatever reason, it really struck me. And actually, now that I think about it, my dad, I remember his music collection. He was really into jazz. Like, he was into, like, Dave Brubeck, you know, and John Coltrane.
Yeah.
And so there was, like, some soul in the music that he liked, but it was never hip-hop or even soul to, you know, traditional soul. Like,
right.
he never went down the sort of, like, James Brown or Stevie Wonder world. He stayed in jazz.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, like, if you hear, you know, if you hear Tribe, you know, if you hear, like, Beat Nuts, like, there's, like, a connection where, like, wait a second, I've heard that
hook. Oh, totally.
Hook. Yeah, yeah,
somewhere before.
Yep, yep. And so my young brain was like, damn, this is really dope. And then, of course, there's just the energy of, like, b-boying and DJing. And then I mentioned the mixtape culture.
Yeah.
And there was this shop in the Village called Unique Boutique, where they would, you know, airbrush on the back of denim jackets, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, Black Bart Simpson and, like, you know, skateboarding Homer and stuff like that. Like, they do all these funny things. And just, can you imagine, like, just a kid from Jersey absorbing all of this stuff? That's what really struck with me at that early age. And it would end up forging my whole life, you know?
Yeah, just, it's crazy how those experiences and those, you know, that snapshot of years can just stick with you for, like, infinite, you know, amount of time,
your
entire lifespan.
I remember, by the way, you know, in the Village, that's where New York University's campus is. It's right there
smack
in the Village.
Down.
And I remember I'd see the flags, the NYU flags. And before I even got into high school, in like middle school, I told my mom, I'm going to NYU.
Why? Just because, like, you kept seeing it?
Just because, like, you know, by the time I got to start picking colleges, I didn't want to be behind, like, some walled community in a campus.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wanted to be, whatever school was happening in the Village,
yeah.
I wanted to be in that school.
You wanted to be mixed into things.
I went to NYU.
But before you went to NYU, though, I had read that you kind of got into sneakers at, like, super young age, like sixth grade or something like that.
Yep,
what sneaker was it?
I mean, I was always into sports, so I was buying athletic shoes to play sports in.
Okay.
The shoe that I credit with, like, really turning me into a sneakerhead is the Air Jordan 3.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, to put it to you this way, like, I had bought the AJ1. I couldn't afford the AJ2s, but, like, the AJ1 I bought them to play ball in.
Yeah. You know, and they were, like, $65. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And they had the blue, they had the Royals and they had the Breds, you know, and I got them both, but I bought them to play basketball in. And the 3 was something else where, like, when the 3 came out, I was like, these ain't for basketball.
Nah.
These are for flossing, like, as a sixth grader. Like, it's weird. That's the power of design. You know what I mean? The power of design is that, like, Tinker Hatfield and MJ were able to create something that a sixth grader could immediately understand that this is flyer than what is meant for the basketball.
Whatever else is out there and whatever else is falling, this is, like, a whole different thing.
This is something else. Yeah, yeah. And you know what's funny is, like, I remember I used to wear those, and then I'd come home, and I would take a toothbrush and just start, like, brushing up the bottom.
Yes.
And, like, sometimes the paint on the back plate there would, like, come off, and I would take white out and, like, really reapply the paint. And it's like, no one instructs you to do that. There's no, like, sneakerhead documentary or some shit, you know, like, it's just like something told me, like, no, I must preserve these.
Yeah. Did your parents, like, ever see you doing this and just think, like, what are you doing?
they thought I was so ridiculously crazy. We had a dining room that was only used for special occasions. You know, it had like the china that, like, you know, the china plates, and, like,
this
is only the special occasion thing. So it was never used. That room became my sneaker closet. Like, I just started lining the dining room with shoes. They didn't understand what was going on. I remember one time the Jordan 4, wait, which one's the, no, Jordan, it was still Jordan 3. It was the clear bottom Jordan 3. The grapes came out.
Right.
And we were going on a vacation. We went to Hawaii, and I brought the grapes. I was stoked. And one day we were like, we're going to visit a beach, right? So I was like, cool. And so I wore the grapes, and it turns out that it's, like, the famous black sand beach of Hawaii.
Oh, my goodness. I've been there.
Okay. So I've got clear bottom threes on, like, you know, where the jump man is seen on the bottom.
I know exactly,
like,
what you're talking about.
Right?
On the bottom.
I'm like, I'm about to stand on a black sand beach with these shoes on. Nah. I was like freaking out and shit. So like, the genius in me, I thought, like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm gonna buy a roll of Scotch tape. And I'm going to Scotch tape the bottom of my shoes. Yeah, I Scotch taped the bottom of my shoes. And my thinking was that, like, when I'm done with the beach, I'll just peel off the tape and it'll be, like, perfectly preserved, yeah. Right? Little did I know, the black sand beach is, like, 180 degrees on the surface. And so, like, it was like I was stepping on gum. Like, the coagulation, like, it just melted the tape onto the bottom of my shoes. And I remember I got back to the hotel that we were staying at, and I was like so just like depressed because I just ruined my kicks.
Just ruined them.
And I'm sitting here, I'm sacrificing the one toothbrush that I brought to just like try to scrub the bottom. And then my dad's just like, so how are you gonna brush your teeth now? I was like, I don't care.
I don't care.
I don't need teeth. I don't need to. I just need this to be good.
Right.
And I remember actually as a young, and I remember I finally dropped it all, and I was like, you know what? There's more important things in life. Like, cavities are more important than the bottom of my shoes. So
you got,
like,
tired of going to the dentist.
Yeah, I had a reality check.
Man, so, you know, you got this crazy interest in sneakers, and you kind of start to even out and figure, like, maybe that's not the most important thing in the world. And when you were deciding to go to NYU, I think you were interested in journalism, right?
Whoa. Kind of. I mean, interested is a very strong word in this case. You know, my Chinese parents were very much of the mindset that, like, we came here to have you. You're the first American. You're the first person to even go to high school. Like, neither of my parents went to a high school. Now you finish high school. Now you're going to college. You're mm-hmm. going to be like a doctor or a lawyer. You're going to be an mm-hmm. upstanding, six-figure earning, BMW driving citizen of America.
Right.
Right. And my track record in academics was not the destiny. Like, it wasn't looking like I was a 2.0 GPA. I had like a 10-10 on my SATs. I was just like coasting. Like, yeah.
Were you just not interested?
Best. I was just like every other lost middle America suburban kid that, like, had no drive and no passion and didn't know what they wanted to do in life, you know. Gotcha. Which is like 95% of the kids in you know, in a suburb, you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. They just want to do dumb stuff, kid stuff, and play video games and, like, joyride in their parents' car, you know, like,
yeah,
just
no.
stupid stuff.
Yeah,
yeah,
live carefree.
Yeah, and I had no direction, you know. So you know, doctor, medicine, law, business, not in my cards. Mm-hmm. But there was a woman back in the day on television, and her name was Connie Chung. Hmm. Connie Chung was a newscaster on TV. She's a legend. And the thing is like, there's so few, like, Asian faces that look like us on television.
Of course,
that,
right.
Like, when there's like one, there's like Bruce Lee, Connie Chung, Michael Chang, there's like three, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? And so Connie Chung was a newscaster, and my parents were like, maybe you could do news. Like, that's respectable. Like, if you work for a newspaper or magazine. And I was actually into, personally, I was into creative writing.
Okay.
But I didn't think that being like a creative author was a career choice.
Yeah. You didn't know, like, that was like, oh, you can get paid to do this.
Nah, not at all. So I was like, maybe I'll try my hand at journalism as like a sort of way I could make money. I could maybe work for a magazine or a newspaper. I could write, and I could maybe be creative a little bit, but mm-hmm. it's respectable. So I did go to NYU for journalism, barely got in, and yeah, it was dope. I mean, and again, the biggest takeaway from NYU was really just seeing people who looked like me. That was like the biggest takeaway.
Yeah, because you mentioned like you went there and you're like, yo, there's a Asian community here. Like, what's going
it's
on?
Crazy. Yeah. I joined every Asian club. I'm Chinese, but I joined the Korean club, the Indian club, the Taiwanese club. Like, I want it all.
Because you felt like you've been deprived for so long.
Yeah, exactly. And I was just learning and learning. It was really dope. I mean, like, you know, up until that point, I had only dated white girls. No offense to white girls, but that's all I had to choose from
right.
in high school. And I think on like the second day of school, I had a Chinese girlfriend.
You fell in love quick.
I fell in love on the lunch line. Literally, I met her on the lunch line on the first day of school. And by the second day of school, we were already dating.
Come on, man. So safe to say you were enjoying yourself in college at NYU.
Oh, yeah. And NYU was dope. And I lived in, I lived really far from NYU, actually. Mm. I didn't live on campus. I lived in an apartment in an area called Bushwick, which now is sort of like a hip, cool area.
Yep.
But back then, Bushwick was like, what rap songs were made about.
Yeah, don't, you like, know, don't like, go over there.
Don't go to Bushwick. I lived in Bushwick, which was like a 45-minute you know, commute into the city. Mm-hmm. But again, that whole thing of like taking the subway, you know, just living that New York City real deal lifestyle was just really just so much fun. So much fun, man.
Man. And now, yeah. But did you, like, how were you enjoying kind of the journalism major? Like, were you interested in
it? Oh, I hated
school.
Really? I hated school. Hated classes. Hated school. Never studied. Skipped as many classes as I could. Yeah, man. The thing about liberal arts school, and I can't speak for every school, but basically it's all about, like, rote memorization, right? Like, you can pretty much skip the entire semester. And if you don't sleep for the last week before midterms and finals and just memorize everything, take the test, you should be able to get like a C. I'm not saying you're gonna get A, and I would get C's. I would not go to class, not study, not read.
And just cram.
Crash, like just crazy study for seven straight days, no sleep in the library, read everything, go straight from the library, not sleeping, into the test room, take the test, get a C, and repeat. That's what I would do. And I didn't know what I was doing to myself. I mean, I was obviously paying a lot of tuition to rob myself of an education.
Right.
But again, young kid, dumb stuff. You just wanted to live carefree. Yeah, exactly. So it's terrible. I was a terrible student. And I think this is why I can connect with people now, because I'm not like a prodigy. You know what I mean? I'm not like Tiger Woods or like this amazing artiste that was like born with this incredible ability. Like, I understand what it means to have no direction and not know what the hell you want to do and just be in like this like passion limbo. Like, you just don't know what you want to do.
Right. And it's a weird place to be. I definitely have felt that and been there, and just like, you know, I felt like, and I don't know about you, like, did you feel like you grew up where you're like, maybe like some of your peers did have it, and like, and that's why you felt it so much? You felt like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And, you know,
no, actually, where I came from, there was not one inspirational person that I could look up to, which in some way is worse. I guess they're both worse, because on the one hand, it's like, I'm never going to be that person, you know? And on the other hand, if there's no role models, there's no one to aspire to either, you know?
Yeah. So you don't know if you should be even doing better.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you real quick, my job since I was 13 years old, I developed film at a photo lab. I swept hair at a hair salon. I bussed tables at a Chinese restaurant. I was rewinding videotapes at a Blockbuster Video. I sold sneakers at a mall. Sporting equipment at a sporting goods store. I mean, these were like the jobs. There's more. There's way more. I delivered pizzas. That was a very lucrative job. This is just like plain Joe, nothing, you know, regular stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
it's just like,
no Jeff Staple, maker of the pigeon, happening here. No.
Not happening. This is not in the journey yet.
No, I was vacuuming at the Chinese restaurant, like bussing tables. Like, that was me.
That was you. And then, you know, the college thing didn't seem like it was working out. Did you finish at NYU?
No, I didn't finish NYU. So I was getting odd jobs while I was in New York.
Okay.
You know, money was never something that we had abundance of. We weren't poor. We were like low to middle class. But I had to work if I wanted any spending money. You know? So I had all these weird jobs that I mentioned. And, you know, back then, you know, it's funny because people right now, like, a big hot topic is like minimum wage right now.
Oh, yeah. It's
current events, right?
It's the topic.
Yeah. Back then, I remember if you found a job that was like $8 an hour, you were stoked. Like, $8 an hour
$8 an hour.
The bomb back then. And you know, you would look for jobs in a newspaper. And I remember you just basically look for which number was the biggest, like 825, 850, 875. 875 is the job I'm getting. I don't care if it means toilet washing.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is. It's 50 cents more an hour, right? Mm. So I found a job while I was at NYU that offered $12 an hour. And I was like, what is this?
Yeah,
this is
crazy. What was this job?
It was a job at what was known as a desktop publishing agency, which is the precursor to a graphic design studio. So It's a graphic design studio that only does like books and magazines, mm-hmm. which is called desktop publishing.
Okay.
Back in the day. And so it was a desktop publishing studio that wanted someone to answer the phones and take messages. Data entry.
Right? Wow.
Data entry. And so I was like, I'm going to apply. And so I applied. I got the job. And as I was sitting there, the first thing they said was like, we don't use Microsoft Word and Microsoft Excel here. I was like, oh, okay. Well, how do I give you the messages?
Yeah, what do you do?
They were like, this is a program that is a precursor to Adobe InDesign. It's called Quark Express.
And I've never heard of this.
If you know Quark Express, you are old head. But Quark Express, they said like, we use Quark Express, Photoshop, and Illustrator.
Huh.
So that's what we use. So I was like, I don't know how to do those things. He's like, we're gonna teach you how to do them. So, you know, here I am using a program like Adobe Illustrator just to relay voice messages to people and stuff.
Yeah.
And like make shipping labels for envelopes. I was making them in Illustrator. And so I'm playing around in Illustrator and I'm just like, wow, this is a really, you know, I started playing around beyond.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Because
yeah. And I was like, this is dope. New. This program's dope. Wow. Gaussian blur. What the hell is this? You know? Yeah. So I started playing around and the owner, Scott Carson, you know, he was just like, yo, if you want to learn more, I'll teach you more. You know, and he took me under his wing. And
so
really
you finally found a mentor that kind of like could help you expand.
Mentor
kind of
number
this place.
One, man.
Okay.
Yep. And he taught me and he there was a division of this desktop publishing company that offered like sort of after hours classes to professionals, like mm-hmm. night school mm-hmm. to professionals to teach like old executives how to use these programs.
Yeah.
I got so good at Photoshop, Illustrator, and Quark Express so fast that I became a teacher. I became an instructor like within a year. That's how much I love this. And going back to that idea of like finding your passion, once you lock into something and it's like, this is it, this is my crack, like I can't stop doing this, like that was it for me. It was design, it was graphic design, it was like these programs. And so I was doing that. And then I went back to NYU and mm-hmm. I was trying to figure out like, hey, how do I change my major?
Right.
Yeah, change my classes or whatever so I could start taking this. And at the time, NYU didn't offer anything like this. They do now. They have a really good design program now. But back then, they had no design program. So they just straight up said, we don't have anything like this. And so I was like, oh, man, that sucks. I'm like in debt, student debt. I'm like paying a lot of money for tuition.
And you don't even want to do anything with this major.
Yeah. I can't even pick the right food at this salad bar that I'm paying a lot of money for, you know? So my boss, Scott, he was like, you know, Parsons School of Design is like just 14 blocks up from NYU. Hmm. And it's one of the best design schools in the world. Why don't you apply to that? So I tried to apply to Parsons and I managed to get in and I quit NYU. None of the credits from NYU transferred to Parsons. So I dropped out of NYU and just started over at Parsons.
Jeez, so you had to completely start all over, like no transition.
I started as a freshman again at Parsons.
And what was the gap between you leaving NYU and Parsons? Was it like a semester or a year? Like what was?
Nope, just no gap, just the summer. It was literally like sophomore finished as NYU and that summer happened. And then I got into Parsons that September.
Jeez, so now you're in design program at Parsons. And you're cool with it? You're engaged? Like, what's happening with this?
Loving it like crazy. But it's weird. And I'm sure a lot of, like, creatives go through this and a lot of entrepreneurs go through this. But, like, I was personally very fulfilled. But imagine what my parents felt when I said, I'm dropping out of NYU and I'm not going to be Connie Chung, this great journalist. Like, I'm going to art school.
Oh, I'm sure. Ta-da! I'm sure the disappointment was, it was very transparent.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for real. Like, they were like, I thought you said art school, but I'm assuming I heard wrong. And I'm like, no, art school.
And they're like, what are you going to do with it? I'm sure that was the question. What are you, how are you going to make a living? How are you going to take care of yourself?
I remember vividly, I remember vividly, my parents were like, so does this mean you're going to be an art teacher when you graduate? Like, because being an artist was not even like, being an artist? No, you can't make money doing that. Like, you're going to be an art teacher, I guess, you know? And of course, I didn't even have an answer. I was just like, this is just feels so right to me that I just want to pursue this rabbit hole and see where it leads. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I dropped out of NYU. So, and like, you know, even I remember, not that I'm really trying to like trace back to all my girlfriends back then, but like, I just remember like even my girlfriend from NYU was like, you're losing your mind. Like, why would you leave New York University, you know, esteemed university to go to art school? And you're not like a really great artist. Like, it'd be one thing if you were like this phenom artiste and then you go to art school to hone that. But like, you're not really a great artist either, you know? And I wasn't, quite frankly. And so like, I could see why it didn't make any sense to my loved ones. And so even though I was personally feeling very fulfilled, I felt the outside world kind of like hating on me.
Yeah. You
know? Like, they were player hating.
It started to creep in. It just started to be like, you had this idea for where you wanted to go. But like, all of us have to start to realize, and especially when you're on this path, that no one's going to understand until you get to a certain place. And then they're like, oh, I always believed in it.
Dude, and let me, I just remembered too, like this other factor, NYU at the time was about $30,000 a year.
Sheesh.
I mean, I got a little bit of aid, you know, and I got a little bit of student loan and stuff, but you still got to eventually pay the $30,000 a year.
Right, right.
So second year of NYU, I'm $60,000 in debt with nothing. I'm walking away with not even like an associate's degree, like nothing to show for it, you know? So that's my parents were just like, you're just going to flush $60,000 down the toilet because now you want to go be an artist?
Yeah.
Like that, like even to me, that sounds crazy.
It does, because right you now. You can't say you have another plan in place, right? All you can say is you just have this feeling.
Passion.
Right.
That's it.
So you
means nothing to an Asian parent.
Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
So what happens? What happens after you go to Parsons? What starts to take shape?
I mean, in Parsons, you know, I'm surrounded by a network of like-minded folks that, like, you know, sort of are trying to visualize and conceptualize. So even the language that I'm speaking to people is really different. And, you know, I mentioned earlier in talking to you about hip-hop culture. And so on a parallel path of this sort of, like, design DNA that was being embedded in me through Parsons and the network that I had with the students there... Parallel pathing was hip hop culture and the real golden age of hip hop culture in New York City. And I was just going out every night to every hip hop club, open mic night, slam poetry jam. Like, dude, downtown New York City, you got to understand the mecca of like Saul Williams, the Fugees, the Roots, like Mos Def, Talib Kweli, like all of these people were being born and honing their skills in downtown New York
City. And you got to go see them whenever you
wanted to. I got to go stand first row and watch Black Thought like hone his skill in front of me. Like Black Thought was spitting on me and I was like loving it. You know what I mean? Like, so there was that path also. And so if you sort of add the graphic design, artistic impressionism plus hip-hop, what was happening there, and you add those two things together, that to me, I credit that as the DNA for Staple.
Wow.
That's what was being born at Staple in my head.
Yeah.
You know? And so I did a, you know, streetwear back then was not even a term. There was no
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, was that even a thing? Like, it couldn't have been because there was no description for what was happening.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing back then, if you didn't wear Gap and Abercrombie, was like, you know, urban wear is what they called it, right? Like FUBU, Mecca, Peli Peli, you know, these were the big brands. Rockaware, Sean John, right? These were like big brands that if you were quote unquote down, you would wear
this
these
is what
brands,
you were right? in, right, right.
Yep, exactly. And the other contingency is also like if you were a white kid and you were down, then you would wear like skate clothes. You would wear like DC, you know,
Jinko.
Dub drawers. Yeah, Junko, exactly. Yeah. I'm just calling it like it is, right, man. Don't blame the mess.
Don't blame me.
Yeah. So it was Urban Wear. And then there was a couple of little brands here and there that were doing something different. And I really credit, like, Triple Five Soul was a brand back then. Mm-hmm. And there was another brand called PNB Nation. So P as in Paul, N as in Nancy, B as in boy. Or actually what it stood for was P stood for proud, N stood for Nubian, B stood for brothers.
Mm.
PNB. So it was founded by 4-5% Muslim brothers. And they had a streetwear brand. It was called PNB Nation. And I interned for them while I was going to Parsons, while I was going to these open mic nights all night long. So I'm trying to paint a picture of, like, New York City for you here.
Right. And what your life was like during that time.
Yeah. And I'm trying to, you know, like, just understand what these guys were doing. And they were just, like, printing shirts and trying to keep them, you know, like, for the right audience, mm-hmm, and not going too big and stuff. And I fell in love with the whole thing, you know. And shout out, actually, I don't know if you've ever crossed paths with this guy. He's at Nike Sportswear now, I think. His name is Brew McHale.
Mm.
And Brew was the founder of PNB Nation. And he was half Chinese and half Jamaican. And because I'm Chinese, he sort of took me under his wing as, like, a stepbrother, mm-hmm, if you will. You know, and it was dope because, like, just his validation for what I was trying to believe in was monumental, you know. And so learning the chops at this very early stage streetwear brand, I started to want to silkscreen t-shirts and make my own t-shirts and stuff. So they, you know, thankfully Parsons, you know, God bless them, they offered a silkscreen class. And so I started taking silkscreening to learn how to do that. But the class was silkscreening on paper only. It was only for poster printing. Yeah. And I told the teacher, like, I want a silkscreen on t-shirts. And she was like, you can't do that in this class. You can't do that at Parsons, period.
Why not?
And I was like, why? Yeah, that's exactly what I said. I was like, why not?
Like, what's the, that's why? Crazy. That's, like, bizarre to be like, I can't switch out a material.
No. She's like, and when I asked why not, she said, just because.
Huh.
And I hate that answer.
Yeah.
I hate,
yeah,
like, validate your reason to me, but, like, I cannot accept just because.
It's a lazy way of just trying to get you out of their hair.
It's the rule makers. It's the gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and I would face hundreds of gatekeepers in the future. But, like, she was maybe the first one right there.
Yeah.
And so me and a friend were just like, you know what? F that. Like, let's just leave the windows unlocked on the silkscreen lab. And at night, we'll just come in here and start printing
t-shirts.
Come on.
So you were, like, sneaking in.
That's exactly what we did. We snuck in at night. And we would crawl in through the windows with, like, a pillowcase filled with blank tees that we would buy in Chinatown. And we would just set up shop and just start printing. And we would mess up. And, like, it was so much fun just learning how to, like, silkscreen properly.
What were some of the designs? Do you remember?
Yeah, of course. they were mad political. You know, PNB, being that it was, like, owned by, like, 5% Muslims,
mm-hmm,
was, like, a very politically driven, as the kids would say now, woke, you know. So, like, it was a very woke brand. And so I was, you know, I was inspired by that. And I was doing very, like, deep message shirts. I remember the first series was, like, I wanted to do this series called Never Forget, which is, like, incidences in American history that we should never forget or will repeat, you know. So I did, like an American Indian headdress that was burned on the front of a shirt, and then on the back it would say never forget.
Hmm.
I did the chains that they would enslave, you know, slaves from Africa, and I put that on the front of a shirt, put never forget. There's that classic scene of, like, the Chinese protester that was getting, like, run over by the train in Tiananmen Square.
Hmm.
I put that on the front of a shirt, said never forget. So those are my first shirts. And I would just get, I wasn't trying to start a fashion brand. I was just making art on the medium of t-shirts and giving them out to my friends.
Right. And isn't that such a fun time? Like, there's nothing attached to it. It's pure creativity.
No. Exactly. No obligation of, like, ROI or sales or sell through. Just, you know, and it was cool because, to me, as a New Yorker, you know, if I were to, you know, other friends who are making prints in the class would give the 50 prints to their friends.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, you never go into other people's apartments in New York City. They're too small. You know, you can't have gatherings in a studio apartment. So I was of the mindset, like, man, if I gave a t-shirt to my friend and he's taking the train and the subway and the bus and there's, like, thousands of people seeing his t-shirt,
mm-hmm,
that's great. Going back to graffiti, that is great graffiti advertising, you know?
Jeez, it's crazy to think back. Like at that age, you were already thinking through like marketing. Because essentially, that's marketing. You're thinking guerrilla marketing.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't know it was called guerrilla marketing. I was inspired. The thing I really loved about graffiti was the fact of like you could paint, tag, you know, inscribe your name on the side of a bus or a train. Mm-hmm. And tens of thousands, if not millions of people could see it. And some people will say, well, that's wrong. But then how, to me, I was always like, what is the difference between that and like a billboard or like a political poster? Like when you know when like there's an election in your city and like people stick the thing in the lawn, yeah, and they're like, vote for on yeah, every lawn. Like,
every lawn, yeah.
That's graffiti. That is graffiti to me. You know what I mean? But it's like, it's just like sort of like washed by like government and corporate election and stuff. But like, it's the same concept. It's that dude's name on every lawn. Mm-hmm. So well, how is that different than this dude's name on every train? Yeah. You know what I mean? So I always was like, I love that subversion. And so just seeing people around campus, like rocking my shirts every once in a while that I gave them for free was pretty cool. But again, at the time I had this, I was a freshman right now, mm-hmm, you know, first year in Parsons. I had no intention of like being a fashion brand owner or anything like that.
When we come back in just a moment, Jeff goes on a hunt that will take him to Japan and change his life and sneakers forever. Hey, everyone. The Claim of Stories podcast is supported by Converse. If you're a fan of Chuck 70s like we are, be sure to visit converse.com and pick up a new pair. Also, we wanted to share a little behind the scenes with you about the recording of the show. Each week, we produce new episodes from our new studio in Portland, Oregon. As we've grown, we wanted a space inspired by our love of mid-century modern design. We were able to achieve this with the help of our friends at The Good Mod and PDX Original. Hey, it's Bima. Welcome back to Claim of Stories. It's the early 2000s, and Jeff is on the hunt to figure out who was signing off on the Nike Japan product he would see imported into the United States.
There was about 3 or 4 shops and boutiques in New York that were selling this thing called, about to be called streetwear. They weren't selling urban wear and they weren't selling skatewear. It was some melding of the mm-hmm two. And those few shops, there was like 555 Soul, which I mentioned. There was Union, which is still around. There's a Union in LA. Union, everyone knows now Union is the people who make Jordans. Like, no, no. Union is like the OG streetwear right shop. There was Babito Garcia. Right. Babito had a shop called Babito's Footwork. And there was a shop called Swish, which was owned by my man, Tony. And those were pretty much the 4 stores. And I remember one day I was wearing one of my shirts. It was actually my birthday, March 7th, 1997. So it's my birthday in 2 days.
Oh, man. Happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you. You're the first one. So I was wearing my shirt, walking around Soho. And I walked into the 555 Soul store on Lafayette in Soho. And I remember the manager said like, yo, where'd you get that shirt? That's a cool shirt. And I was like, oh, I made it. I made this shirt, you know? And he's like, that's dope. He's like, you know, would you, if you bring like a dozen of these shirts into the shop, we could sell them here.
Huh.
I was like, okay.
And had y'all like talked about like price or anything like that? Or were you just going off of what you had saw maybe in the store?
Yeah, I had no idea. I mean, like, yeah, I just literally said, okay, I'll be back. You know, and then don't forget, I had to like break into school with my friend, right, and like print shirts. And then I was hand printing the shirts, brought 12 back, and they sold really well. And I remember the manager of Union, shout out Vito, he approached me and he was like, yo, I saw the shirts selling in 555 Soul. We would love to get a dozen at Union. Uh-huh. You know, so then he would buy 12. And then 555 would be like, yo, let me get 24 now. And then Union would be like, let me get 36. And it just like kept ping pong. And I was getting paid.
Getting
I was like
paid.
Invoicing, getting paid. Yeah.
And were you so still making the shirts? You were like,
yes.
Okay.
I'm still breaking into school, making the shirts. And it's like crazy because the damage rate of the shirts that I was making was really high. Like in order to get 12 good shirts, I probably would have printed 20 and like 8 would have gotten messed up somehow.
Yeah.
You know, and so the 8 would go to my friends, and then I finally have 12 perfect ones, and then I would deliver them. But so when you're getting up to like 45 to 50 shirt orders, mm-hmm, I'm like printing 75 to 80 shirts to get 50 right. It was a terrible business model. But I was having so much fun, man. And now what was really inspiring to me was I started seeing people in downtown New York City that I didn't know wearing my stuff. So that was really cool to see people that I didn't know wearing my brand. That was the beginning of Staple, really.
Jeez. You didn't have any real guidance outside of the interest of just people wanting to come pick up your product, or people like saying, hey, like Union, just like, yo, I want to put in, you know, order 24. There was no way for you to know, like, kind of what you were doing week to week.
No, not at all. I mean, I was still going in school. I still had a job, you know. I had two jobs actually at the time. Now that I think about it, I was a full-time student. I was interning at a graphic design studio, a new one, a separate one, mm-hmm. not the first one that I mentioned. I was doing this thing called Staple. And at night, I worked at a like sort of a bootleg version of Kinko's, like a 24-hour copy shop that wasn't Kinko's, but trying to be Kinko's. Mm-hmm. And I would do the graveyard shift from 12 a.m. to 3 a.m. at this Kinko's thing, making photocopies and color prints and stuff.
Jeez.
And sleeping from 4 a.m. to like 8 a.m. and then going back to school and starting all over again, you know?
How are you finding the energy for this? Was it just youth? Like, because it sounds like you were grinding.
It was New York City, man. Hmm. It was just the energy and the hustle of New York. And it was a beautiful time, like with hip hop culture and like, you know, and the burgeoning of streetwear and stuff, and just living the dream, man.
Yeah.
It was dope. Yeah.
Who was that?
And it was exhausting. I remember I did that for 9 straight months of just grinding, full-time student. And I remember one night after I had gotten off of my midnight shift job, I was skating home at like 3 a.m. Mm-hmm. And I got into like, I skated over like this massive truck nut bolt type thing.
Yeah.
That I didn't see. And I just went tumbling for like 2 city blocks, like just like Tasmanian devil, just like flipping. And when I finally stopped rolling, I was like laying on the side of the street, like just sprawled out.
Yeah.
And I was like, Jeff, it's time to make a decision.
Hmm.
Like, it's time to stop something. And it was a real great life lesson to just be like prioritization, listening to yourself, asking yourself what you want to do, what do you love the most, you know. And I couldn't stop the jobs because I needed,
you needed
the money. Yeah. There was no way I was going to stop the momentum on Staple and just this interaction with hip hop culture and street culture, because it was just way too inspiring. Mm-hmm. You know, like the energy.
It's
was
like
amazing.
Your lifeblood.
Yeah. Crazy. Like, I just remember one time somehow I was at a Roots show, and there's a guy on the Roots named Razel, who was like, he's like the illest beatboxer on planet Earth, and he's in the Roots. And somehow, like, it got word to me that Razel was a fan of my brand.
Hmm.
And if I could meet him backstage and like give him a shirt, you know. Oh, I'll tell you another story. Mos Def, aka Yasin Bey, mm-hmm. was my first lookbook model.
How in the world did you pull that off?
I was interning at his record label called Raucous, and I was showing him what I did, and he's like, yo, this stuff is really dope. And I was like, would you be down to take a couple pictures? And he's like, you know what? I'll tell you what, if you can do the photos from here down the elevator to my car, we'll do it.
Wow.
And I shot him in the elevator going down the Raucous building, and I got the illest shot of Mos wearing my stuff. Went into the car, and I made an entire campaign around that around that shot.
So you mean to tell me you didn't have time to put together, like, you know, a whole mood board? You weren't able to like get reference shots and get the lighting right?
And this elevator was like, it fit 3 people max. Like, I was just like just trying to take pictures.
Yeah.
But that I'm telling you these stories only to tell you the energy that was happening in New York then.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was just like so just raw. And so I wasn't giving that up. And the last thing was school. And hell, I was already a one-time dropout. Might as well be a two-time dropout now. You know, after you drop out of school once, it becomes an easier conversation to your parents. Like, so, you know, the art school thing? Yeah, I'm gonna leave that too.
Wow.
And at that point, they were just like, wow, you dropped out of NYU, went to art school, tried to be an artist. Mm-hmm. Obviously not working out because you're dropping out of art school now. Like, just give up. We give up.
Did they know? Like, did they know about your apparel line? Did they know you were?
Hell no. No, they didn't understand anything. Like, when you tell a Chinese parent that, like, I'm making clothing, they think, like, oh, you're, like, the Gap? Like, you're making clothes? Like, it's... So where's your store? Where's the shop at?
Yeah.
I'm like, nah, there's not really a store. Like, oh, how much money are you making? Not that much. Yeah, no, they didn't understand that. They didn't even understand my job as, like, as a graphic designer. You know, I was interning at Raucus, I mentioned, and... I actually also worked at, like, the Fader magazine for a bit, like, as a freelancer, you know what I mean? And, like, I remember I would bring home an issue of the Fader that I did. You know, I would design every page in the Fader magazine. And I remember I was so proud. I brought it to my parents. I was like, look, Mom, look what I did. This magazine, man, it's amazing. Did the whole thing. She was like, oh, you mean you wrote all these articles? I was like, no, I didn't write the articles. Yeah. She's like, oh, you took all the pictures. I was like, no, I didn't take any of the pictures. She's like, oh, did you print the magazine? Are you the printer of this magazine? I was like, no, I didn't print it either. She's like, you didn't do anything. I don't know what.
Wow.
She's like, I don't understand. Yeah.
So you, it started kind of shifting you to a place where you're like, this design thing, I'm probably not going to share with them at this point in time.
Exactly.
Because it's not something that they seem to kind of grasp.
Yeah. And you know what? I have a bad habit of doing that to this day. Like, not sharing things that I'm working on because I'm just so automatically institutionalized to think that people won't get it.
Yeah.
You know?
It's already a certain point until people are ready to understand what you've been doing. And it's usually after other people have come on board.
Yeah, exactly. And this was even after, like, stores were buying my brand and, like, strangers were walking into those stores to buy my brand. I still was, like, embarrassed to tell my parents about it, you know? So I gave up school. And I just decided to work and then use all that time. You know, it didn't help that school was costing me money too. So, like, I can now sort of invest that money into the brand, you know?
Right. So outside of kind of selling it wholesale to some of these different shops, did you ever end up getting your own space to work out of or anything like that?
A store or a...
Like a store or a workshop or a studio?
In the beginning, I had a studio apartment in Chinatown. That I operated Staple out of. And it was, like, literally a shoebox-sized apartment with a bed in the middle of it and then just racks floor to ceiling of clothes, you know? And I had sewing machines in there and I had friends come over and they would, like, do label changing, poly bagging, stickering, attaching hang tags, like, A to Z, was in this studio apartment. I was playing basketball still and I remember, like, after a outdoor run, you know, a couple of friends that were playing basketball with me would be like, yo, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm going to pack orders. That's what I'm going to do now. And they were like, they were actually like, that sounds fun. Can we come over and help pack orders? And so they would come over and pack orders. And some of those guys ended up becoming like my first quote unquote employees, you know, because they just like hung around.
How did that work out, right? Because, like, it's just, like, the homies, essentially.
Yeah.
And, like, they just ended up starting working. Like, did everybody, like, get along? Was it, like, all chill?
Yeah. Yep. It was dope.
Man.
It was like, you know, I was like, yeah, I'll pay you whatever, $7 an hour, $8 an hour, whatever I could afford. Mm-hmm. I'll buy you dinner, pack orders. It was, people were really, you know, supportive and inspired by this. And I don't even think they knew why, but they just saw this thing that was, like, really interesting of, like, here's this guy, two-time dropout, making t-shirts, and people, like, very niche select people in downtown New York City, all these cool kids. And, like, my second big account was actually, like, a Tokyo Japanese account, you know? And, like, oh, these kids in Japan are buying it. And they're just like, we don't know what's going on, but it's really interesting.
Working.
And it's nothing that's ever been taught to us in school either. You know, no one's ever taught us this business. And so I think a lot of my friends were really enamored by it. And I was just like, that's how I got my first employees. That Japan story is really dope because it's like, I remember I told you I was hand printing shirts and selling them to local shops in New York for about a year. And then this Japanese guy bought one of my shirts at Union and then went back to Japan. And then he called me on my home landline phone. If you remember that those days, he called me at home and he was like, oh, I got your shirt at Union and I want to order some more if you can send them to Japan.
This is wild.
And I was like, oh, that's dope.
Yeah.
And so here I am hand printing shirts like 36, 50 at a time. And he goes, I want to order 1,000 shirts.
I'm sorry, 1,000 shirts?
Yeah, 1,000 shirt order to Japan. And I was like, whoa, like, how am I going to break into school with like 2,000 shirts, screw up on 1,000 of them, and then like ship your order? And I was like, that happened while I was still in school. And so that was one of the big reasons why I quit school, mm-hmm. actually, because I was like, I'm going to try this thing out now. Like, I just got 1,000 shirt order right. in Japan. This is an opening that I'm going to try to take advantage of. And so that's why I got into Japan. And that's actually why Japan and Staple have been so interlocked since like the late 90s. And, you know, Japan is my second home because I've been going there since then.
Since then. Wow. So,
yeah,
you know, Staples like essentially exploding. I mean, 1,000 shirt order in Japan, it's working in New York. And, you know, fast forward to like the early 2000s, you know, there's this is an era where Nike's trying to break into skateboarding and the sneaker scene is growing. It's not as big as what we know is today, but there's a substantial interest in sneakers. And then, you know, somewhere along this line, someone comes knocking on your door to work on your first sneaker collab. How does this happen? You know, this is like the question that, you know, we always think about with sneakers. And I know, you know, the story about the dunk has always been out there, but like, how does it actually happen? Who, like, what relationships allow this to form?
Yeah. I mean, if you go back, as I mentioned, one of my design clients, I guess you would call it, was the Fader magazine. Right? Mm-hmm. And the Fader right now is like a real seminal, important music lifestyle magazine and publication.
Okay.
And they have the Fader Fort and stuff like that. But I was at the ground floor of the Fader magazine. You know, I designed like the first 20 some odd issues of the Fader.
Wow.
Yeah, I created their identity, their logo, everything. And I was even, you know, because of my journalism background, I was also contributing stories and articles, not only designing, you know. So every once in a while, I would take a crack and like write one or two articles. And because I was this sneakerhead since the sixth grade and I had continued to be a sneakerhead, I started to see these little, you know, as you mentioned, very small limited edition projects that Nike was doing. And it was really hard to understand why at the time a big brand like Nike would pick a store in Japan and release 36 pairs.
Right.
For them,
it was super, like way smaller than what we think of today when we think of limited. Like they were doing really small limited pairs.
Yeah. Like less than 50 pairs, you know?
Right.
And so it didn't make sense why, and I wanted to get to the bottom of it. I sort of instinctively knew that if I tried to call Nike in America, in Beaverton, like I wouldn't get replied, like little old me, you know? And I noticed that a lot of these things were coming out of Japan, like Nike Japan. And if you remember, like there was this thing called NikeCO.jp.
Right.
Like they were putting out a lot of these things. And and as I mentioned, Staple at the time was sort of taking off in Japan. So I went to the publishers of the Fader and I pitched them this idea of going to Japan to figure out why Nike was releasing things in limited edition. Mm-hmm. And they approved the story. So they flew me out to Japan, got that trip paid for.
Yeah, got free travel.
Free travel. Also got to do... like, you know, a little bit of side business as well. I went to Japan and I had no leads. I literally had no hookup or no plug into Nike.
Mm-hmm.
I would bring a couple of issues of the Fader with me and I'd walk into a sneaker store in Japan, can't speak Japanese, and I'd be like, I make this magazine. How do you get Nike? And they'd be like, huh? Who gets you Nikes? And they'd give me a business card. And then it'd be their sales rep. It'd be like their low-level Eakin sales rep. You know what I mean? And then so I'd go to that guy and I'd call him up and I'd be like, who's your boss? And then he would give me a manager. And I would just keep building up. I was there for like 2 weeks. And I eventually made my way up to the dude who determined which store in Japan got which crazy shoe and which limited edition number that they would get. Huh. It was one guy. One guy was sort of like just skunk work project, like this whole thing, yeah. You know? Yeah, his name is Marcus Tayui. Huh. And so I met with him, and he was actually Japanese American. Mm-hmm. He was born in America in Cali, but went back to Japan. So he speaks fluent English and Japanese. Yep. And I just said, I want to interview you. And he was like, cool, let's do it. And I went to his office, interviewed him, and it was cool. I got to learn about, you know, it wasn't anything. The answer to the question of why Nike was doing this was not really any big diabolical business movement. Mm-hmm. It was like, he was like, I didn't know what to do with these shoes that Nike was doing. Like, I would get, like, for instance, the Air Woven. Remember that shoe?
Yeah, I remember that. Right.
Like, the Air Woven is a weird freaking shoe.
Yes.
And he's like, you know, Foot Locker and Athlete's Foot ain't buying the Air mm-hmm. Woven. They designed it so I would try to find some really innovative, cool account. Hmm. And back then, actually, one of those accounts wearing the shirt right now, this account, yep. Atmos was one of these accounts. And they'd be like, you know, Atmos was cool. They would carry cool things. And I would ask the owner of Atmos, do you want to buy 24 pairs of this? And Atmos would say, yeah, but can I make one in hot pink and all black?
Oh.
And so they would be like, okay, cool. So we'll make 24 exclusively for you mm-hmm. of the Air Woven, you know, and that's limited edition.
Right.
That's how it happened, you know? And then some kid who was visiting Japan would buy two pairs and then fly them back to New York and triple the price of them at his shop, mm-hmm. you know, and like shops like this were like Clientele was a shop back in the
day.
That did this.
Yep.
Flight Club. This is how Flight mm-hmm. Club was born, you know? And so this sort of parallel importing was happening. Mm-hmm. That's how it started. That's how this whole culture started. And it was going the other way too. So like kids who would get like white Air Force Ones in Baltimore and Philly would fly them back to Tokyo because kids in Tokyo weren't getting white Air Force Ones. And so they were like parallel trading, you know? And so, yeah, I interviewed him. And after the interview, you know, we were just, you know, shooting the shit. And he was like, so wait, so you got like this little t-shirt company called Staple. Mm-hmm. You are the designer of the fader. You also write articles. And, you know, you're a sneakerhead. You know your sneaker stuff. He's like, we should work together.
Wow.
And I was like, yeah. I was like, we should work together. He's like, all right, I'm going to make some phone calls and get you to meet some people in Beaverton, you know?
Come on, man.
And that's how that happened. And that's how the work with Nike started happening. And I'll tell you another crazy thing that he did. He said to me, you know, sometimes when like Atmos says, I want to do this crazy shoe, like, you know, the Woven or like the Kukini or some weird thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they want to make a special colorway. They would ask this other dude to help out with those colorways and help out with like designing the shoe and stuff. Yeah. And I was like, okay. He's like, you should interview this dude for your article. And I was like, okay, cool, bet. I was like, what's his name? He's like, Hiroshi Fujiwara.
Come on. Interview him.
Yeah. So the next day I met with Hiroshi Fujiwara for the first time in 1998, Tokyo, of Fragment Design. And ever since we met, we've been the best of friends on that crazy trip, man.
What are you like? It's so crazy to think back to 98. Like, you had no idea, like, that chance encounter, you following up with people on the cars and trying to get to the manager, that would lead to just life today.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't even really nervous to meet Hiroshi because I didn't even know who he was or what he meant until, like, it's funny because I hired a freelance photographer to help me in Tokyo shoot portraits of everyone. Mm-hmm. And he was helping me the whole time, the whole week. And when I said to him, hey, tomorrow we got one last shoot. We got to shoot this guy, Hiroshi Fujiwara. The photographer was like, oh, no, I can't shoot him. I was like, why? You've been helping me the whole week.
What's up? Right.
He's like, that's God. He just said, that's God. Huh. I can't shoot God. I'm not worthy to photograph God.
My goodness.
And I had to really convince him and pull. He eventually did it. But I was like, come on, just come and shoot this thing.
You know?
And so, like, and other people were telling me, like, yo, you got an interview with Hiroshi Fujiwara? Like, he is the godfather of this whole thing. Like, I can't believe you got an interview. So I was actually really nervous to meet him at the very last minute. Mm-hmm. And we ended up meeting. And I'll tell you this other, after we interviewed in his office, we got along really well. It's like a 2-hour interview. And he was like, what are you doing tonight? And I was like, nothing. I was like, I don't know what to do in Tokyo. I'm on my own here, you know? He's like, why don't you come over to my house? I'm having a barbecue with some friends. I was like, all right, cool. So I go to his house.
Yeah.
And he's like, come into the backyard. And like, so, you know, there's someone barbecuing. Dude turns around and it's Eric Clapton barbecuing on his grill. Right. And I was like, wow, Eric Clapton's just sitting there barbecuing. And then I go to sit on the sofa. You know who's there? James Jebbia from Supreme is just sitting on the
this
sofa.
This story is so unreal.
and then, dude, 10 minutes later, dude walks in. It's this dude named Hiroki Nakamura. And I was like, what do you do? And he's like, I have a brand called Visvim that I'm starting.
Oh, my goodness.
But you got to understand, like, all of this stuff, it's not today.
No.
Right? Like, when someone says, I'm starting a brand called Visvim, I'm like, okay. And I actually knew James a little bit because I rolled downtown and James was downtown. So I knew James as the guy who he owned the Stussy Supreme store, Stussy New York City store and Supreme. But he was just Supreme in 98 was like, it was like Zoo York. Like
any
it was
other
like
shop.
DC. Yeah. Any other skate shop. So I was like, oh, hey, James. You know, but like now you just see like the rising tides of what was happening, you know, and Hiroshi kind of being at the nucleus of all of that was really dope. I was obviously very blessed to have been injected into that culture right then and there. But I will say I was also hunting it down a little bit. Like if it wasn't for my sort of like curiosity and my naivete and the balls of just like asking, can I go to Japan? Yeah. Can I do, you know, like doing all this stuff, like it wouldn't have happened either.
You know? Gotcha. So take me into how you ended up starting to work on this dunk. Like, how does that project come through Nike?
So out of that Beaverton connection through Marcus, we started to work a lot with Nike on various projects, both internally, like internal projects at Nike that never see the light of day, sort of like research, R&D, presentation stuff, packaging design, and then exterior stuff too, like the navigation pack, the Nordic pack, the Laser Rift, the Laser Cortez. There's like a whole bunch of shoes that we were designing, but not collaboration, so to speak, just like design the shoe, you know?
More like agency.
So we were already working with them. I had Reed Space also now at the time.
Okay.
You know, Reed Space was open at my boutique in the Lower East Side of New York. And I had like maybe 5 or 6 employees and Staple was doing pretty well. The clothing line was doing really well. And so Marcus actually had now moved back to Beaverton because rest in peace to Sandy Bodecker. But Sandy, who was a, you know, an OG, like made man from the early days of Nike, he called up Marcus and he said, Nike's going to try the skateboarding thing again. And everyone was like,
oh, here we go.
Like, here we go, please. And they're like, no. Sandy was like, no, we're going to do it right. And Marcus is going to help me. He's like an OG in skate. And so come back to Beaverton and help me start Nike SB. And now Nike, people think Nike SB stands for skateboarding, but don't forget Sandy Bodecker SB was the forefather of this. So it's not a coincidence. So he started Nike SB. And because, you know, me and Marcus kept in touch so well, dude, people don't know this, but like I designed the first Nike SB catalogs. I designed the first Nike SB website.
Jeez. What?
Yeah. So like I was in there from the ground floor.
Right.
And so we were all friends. And then when it came time to like, you know, Marcus gave me a call one day and he was like, you know, we're doing this dunk anniversary in a few years. And we want to do a dunk that's dedicated to New York City. Would you be interested in designing that dunk?
Oh, man. And I was like, of course.
Of course. I was New York. The dunk was an amazing shoe. And I didn't know what it was going to look like yet. I just said yes, you know. And it just so happened that at the time of my clothing brand, I was trying to develop like a mascot and a logo for my clothing brand. Mm. And I was a fan of, you know, Polo Horse, Ralph Lauren. I was a fan of Lacoste and Izod.
All iconic logos.
Yeah, I was, you know, and also respect to Mark Echo and the Echo brand and the Rhino, you know what I mean? I loved all of that stuff. And I was like, I want an animal. I want a mascot, you know? And I picked the pigeon, you know, as my mascot. It was sort of like just to me, the unofficial underdog of New York City and how like everyone just hates, everyone hated on what I was doing. Like, you know, as I mentioned, my family members, I had this chip on my shoulder and the pigeon just really resonated with me. So we adopted the pigeon as our mascot. And then so when the call came in to design the dunk, we actually tried a few different versions of that dunk, like where it might have been like Statue of Liberty or the subway dunk or like, you know, yellow cab dunk and stuff. But, you know, we thought like, wait a second, what if we made this dunk look like a pigeon? Like the whole thing, gray uppers, pink bottom. And then in case you didn't get it, let's just embroider a pigeon on the back of it, right? And people were like, yo, pigeons are flying rats. They're like vermin. Like no one
I was going to say, I'm like, I'm curious to see how this idea is going over. Cause it's like, it's probably more easy to digest the subway or the yellow cab. And then you go off and you're like, nah, we're going to do a pigeon.
Yeah. People were like, nah. And I was like, my argument was like, you wanted a shoe that was dedicated to New York City. We are giving you a shoe that only New Yorkers will get. Mm. Like if you live in Connecticut or New Jersey or Pennsylvania and you know, and you think you know New York and you see the pigeon, you won't get it. Mm-hmm. This is only for people who live and breathe in the city 24/7. That was my pitch back. And they were like, we love it. We love it. We like straight up Marcus and everyone at Beaverton was like, we don't get it, but we love it. Like we love the thinking, you know, and that's a real power to Nike and like shout out to them for, you know, really trusting in their collaborative partners. Like when they pick somebody to collaborate with, they don't really restrict you at all. Mm. Like, you know, other brands are like, oh, you can't do this. It's against brand guidelines, yada, yada, yada. Like Nike's like, I mean, look at Virgil. Like he's like, I want to cut holes in my shoes, you know, and there's a reason for it. And if you support the reason, they'll usually go for it. You know, that's true innovation. And so, yeah, the pigeon dunk was born. And when we released it, it was obviously hectic, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, you know the stories are out there. We know it. It's first shoe to go mainstream.
This is where, like, you can now, you could just Google pigeon dunk if you're not familiar. but yeah, you know, it was a pretty historic release. And I didn't plan for this to happen. I didn't know it was going to happen. But what eventually came about was that pigeon dunk became like an evolutionary step in sneaker culture, where like when it was a niche subculture before that, after that, it became mainstream to some degree, you know, for better or for worse. Some people say for worse, right? Yep. Some argue for better or for worse, but like it did what it did. And to this day, you know, 16 some odd years later, it is still seen as a grail in the culture, and it's a blessing, you know, that I was able to have my name on it. You know, it's my Illmatic.
It's your Illmatic. Wow, that's a powerful statement.
It's my five mic album. You know what I mean? And it's a gift and a curse though, because I don't want to rest my hat on the pigeon dunk and have that be the only thing. But you know. Hey, if Nas walked away and said, I just made Illmatic, he's still top five of all time.
And it's always a part of the conversation. And, you know, I think of that about the pigeon. And it's like, it's always, if you got to talk sneakers, it's always a part of the conversation. But to your point, you didn't stop there, right? Like you ended up doing, you know, your work has continued to evolve over time. Like you, of course, you did other sneakers, whether it was Fila or New Balance, but then you also ventured into other products like Beats by Dre and like you did bicycles. Like you've expanded quite a bit.
Yeah. And there's always been like, to me, if I could compartmentalize my brain, there's two parts. There's one, which is like the evolution of the pigeon and things that I do with the pigeon, which is fun because the expansiveness of where that's gone has been amazing. And then there's the other stuff, which is like, doesn't touch a pigeon, has nothing to do with a pigeon. Yeah. And I've been able to grow that side, like Reed Art Department, the agency or the Business of Hype podcast or like the talks or Skillshare or any, you know, a lot of other things are just like, has nothing to do with pigeon. And it's fun because it's like, this is the dream of like being, you know, everyone says like, I want to be like Ralph, right? Yeah. And to have like polo sport, but then to also be like double RL.
Right, just do whatever.
You know, like I just always wanted to have that. And it's a blessing to be able to have something as powerful as the Pigeon where, you know, people on social media hit me up all the time and they're like, Jeff, I can't look at a Pigeon on the street and not think of your brand. That's like powerful marketing.
That's branding, right? You're able to take this icon, no words, you know, nothing to describe. And it's like, I associate that with Staple. I associate that with Jeff. You know, like that's the beyond. That's what everybody wants when you design.
Yeah. And you know, it's even beyond now the bird. It's like the colors now.
Right.
Like if someone tries to do like a gray, black, white, pink thing, you just read the comments. They're like, yo, I hope Jeff got a check. Like, you know.
And it's great when you reach that point because it's like you don't have to defend it. You know what I'm saying? Like other people will keep the world honest.
Are policing it for me. Yeah.
So, you know, we know about kind of this storyline. It's been talked about so much, but I want to kind of get into like your parallel on the journalism side. Cause you know, you did the work with the Fader and you went on this adventure to Japan and where you met like incredible people that would lead you to the Dunk. And I know you had started this one-to-one like interview series in like 2009, I think like with Mark Echo, and then the list goes on.
Yes. The one-to-one series.
And then when we look kind of in recent history around podcasting, you start this podcast, Business of Hype. What was missing and why podcasting? Because this is before, like right now, even before, you know, when you were ahead on the sneakers, before that was exploding. Podcasting wasn't what it is today. What led you to go down that road?
I was just a fan of podcasts, to be honest. I loved listening to podcasts, and I thought it was a really interesting medium. Because obviously, you know, when I started podcasting, YouTube was really blowing up, right? And video was everything. And all marketing people tell you, like, the kids only want to watch video. Yep. They don't want to read long form. They don't want to listen to long podcasts. Right. Like, you know. And I don't know. It's just the old head in me that I was just like, you know what? I don't want to prescribe to that or keep adding to the static of like consumable, digestible, nugget sized video content. Uh-huh. Like everyone's got to be like, yeah, that's a great story, but can you boil it down to 15 seconds
so it'll
fit
down?
On it? Like, yeah, can you just trim it? Like, no, I cannot trim the story of Hiroshi Fujiwara into a 15
Hell
second
no.
digestible story, you know? So I was like, I love podcasts and I wanted to do it. And at this point in my career, I had already also started to talk to a lot of people as a mentor, you know, sort of guiding them in the game. And I was doing that behind the scenes a lot. And so I knew that a lot of young creative entrepreneurs were seeking guidance. Mm. And I had all these connections. And I also had the blessed ability to be able to sit in a room with someone like a Jerry Lorenzo or a Sean Wotherspoon or like a John Jay and just break bread and like talk, you know, peer to peer, not like journalistic Q&A necessarily.
Yeah.
And if we just set, I just thought like if we set a mic down real discreetly, maybe we could capture a lot of nuggets of information. and that was my pitch. I remember I had dinner one night with Kevin Ma in New York. Kevin Ma is the founder of Hypebeast. Mm. And I had dinner with him and I said I wanted to start this thing. And he was like, how would you like to have it live on Hypebeast? And I was like, that's better than like a Blogspot page.
Right. I mean, also you gotta think about it. Like it's, you know, being on Hypebeast and the millions of people that still come to Hypebeast is like it's a built-in audience.
Yeah. I mean, Hypebeast has become like this the vogue of street culture, right?
Yes.
So I was like, what better place, you know? So he was like, yeah, let's try three episodes. I was like, okay, cool. And literally it was like, I thought after the three, it was going to be a bomb or a bust or like no one would care or I would get tired of it and I would just want to stop. And so the first three episodes were Hiroshi Fujiwara. I decided to like, you know, go back to the Genesis, the Godfather, start there. My second episode was Sarah from Colette, you know, another OG, you know, queen. Mm-hmm. And then the third episode was Aaron Levant, who at the time I caught him just as he was leaving Agenda Trade Show, which was like the premier streetwear trade show, and starting Complex Con. And he had already, to be honest, you know, now he's got this new thing called Network. Mm-hmm. He already had Network in his head. So this guy who had gone from Agenda to Complex Con to Network, another genius, just hustler. And those three episodes just like exploded. Like people just loved it. And I think one of the things that I did that was like a real clutch decision was like after I had listened to the Hiroshi mm-hmm. one, you know, and it's a podcast. You just play the whole right. thing and record it. And I was like, actually, it was Dan Nevada who was like, you should add some like insight right here. Like right here, you should pause uh-huh. it and just say what you were thinking in your head while this conversation was happening. Huh. Yeah. And I was like, all right. So like, I just did a little freestyle ad lib of like what you just heard, like kind of like a recap of what you just heard through my perspective. And people love that. People just love, like, it's one thing to hear it out of the actual person, but to then get it processed mm-hmm. and digested, you know, like back to them in a succinct way. So I call it, we joked and we call it like the cliff notes. It's like, you know, just like the recap, yeah. you know, give me the 10-second recap. People love those things. And I'll drop like 3 to 5 of those things throughout each episode. And it just kept going. And we've done over like 100 of them now at this point. And it became a phenomenon.
Yeah, no, we would tune in, you know, every week for these episodes because it's like you didn't get these conversations anywhere.
Yeah, they're also strangely repeatable. Like I hear people say, like, I just play this one over and over again and I get different nuggets mm-hmm. every time. I saw the night and day difference, you know, like before that, whenever I walk the streets and people will recognize me, they'd be like, yo, Pigeon Dunk, we love it, we love it. Literally after the podcast came out, 9 out of 10 people would be like, I love the podcast. I love the podcast.
Wow.
Like, it was all about the podcast. It was really dope. But it was a labor of love, man. It was like,
what do you mean?
As you know,
it's like you felt like it's like, well, I know what you mean because it's not just sitting down
yeah.
to record. And that's what folks don't realize. There's, you know, right. a lot of work that goes into right. what you do.
Yeah. A lot of prep work, a lot of post work. It really takes a lot out of you to, you know, interview somebody. Like it's like sort of, I call it soul sharing. You're like sharing a soul with another person, you know? And so to do that on a weekly basis or even more, you know, it's really draining. And it's not like I didn't have anything else to do. I still had a creative agency and a clothing line.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I still had a thing to do. But yeah, it's dope. I'm really happy that people love that podcast. And then COVID hit.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, right? And, like, you know, as you know, we're doing it now virtually.
Yeah.
And there are challenges when it comes to recording in separate locations. How did that impact your podcast?
One of the beautiful things about Business of Hype is that I would actually go into people's studios or they would come to my studio and that's how we would do the recording.
Okay.
And I think when COVID hit and we had to do it remote, you know, I was trying to, you know, do it remotely, call in, Zooms and stuff like that. And I really felt like it was different. Like it felt really like just not the same. And maybe that's the difference between being like an older head and like a younger generation. But like I just missed being in person and doing it with somebody in person. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to be like, you know what? I'm gonna hit pause on the podcast until we can really do these in person. Yeah. And every once in a while, I will do one in person if the stars align where like there's like some sort of COVID bubble where like we're both safe and like we both feel comfortable sitting in front of each other for, you know, 2 hours, like less than 6 feet away from each other with no mask. Mm-hmm. But it's rare, you know, like the last 2 episodes I did was with Olivier Rousteing from Balmain
right.
and Hassan Minhaj, where we just happened to be on like a set together. And so we did one. But it's really hard to align. So right now it's on pause and also it's given me a chance to reevaluate how I want to evolve that. You know, whether I do want to, like, you know, you've got this podcast where you've got video. Mm-hmm. Business of Hype never had video on purpose. And maybe I add a video component to it in some way, shape, or form, you know.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens. But people I on the daily I get people asking when is Business of Hype coming back.
So on that, as we kind of close out here, what advice would you have for, you know, young creatives, you know, with this kind of entrepreneurial lens? What advice would you have for them as they're trying to figure out kind of their career path and what they want to do and navigating with, you know, parents' expectations?
Yeah, I would say that word expectation is the thing that you should try your best to mute and ignore if you can. Mm. You know, like the biggest advantage that I had coming up is that everyone thought I would fail.
Hmm.
That's the biggest advantage that I had. because the expectation level was zero. Yeah. Like if I sold 12 shirts, maybe my parents would be like, that's impressive. I thought you would sell zero. You know, so like, and nowadays it's like you drop a tee, and if Drake isn't wearing your tee, something's wrong with your
brand.
Yeah,
yeah. Like, it's like it's not successful. And it's like, when did that become
what the Weeknd has to wear my clothes now for it to be successful? Like, I can't just like make a shirt for me and my six friends. Like that level of expectation is like, and I hang out, I try to really like keep on the street level, and like I see a lot of like young content creators, influencers, designers, whatever it may be, like I see them struggle. Like they're sitting there on Instagram about to post a photo and they're just like shaking, like thinking, is this the right caption?
Wow.
Is this the right time? Am I gonna get the right analytics and impression when I post this? And then they post it and then they didn't get 100 likes in the first hour. So then they delete it because it was like the crop was wrong and I didn't use the right filter. Like, yo, just like mute all the expectations, just put shit out there and just do you. You know what I mean? I know those numbers are debilitating. Those little like numbers and the view number is debilitating because you put something out there and there's six views and it's like it's gut wrenching. And it's cool that the social media companies are learning because I know now Instagram's trying to take away.
I think they hit a ton of the likes from a lot of us. And I actually was like, cool. but
yeah, it's cool. Yeah. It's not about that. This is supposed to be about like creation, not about judgment. And social media has become of this contest. You know what I mean? So if you're out there and you're just starting, I know it's hard, but try to mute out all of those expectations and just create an output and put it out there. And maybe find the platform that doesn't have the judgment.
That was Jeff Staple, designer and streetwear ambassador, whose fingerprint will be left on the design and streetwear world forever. Find out more about Jeff and get access to all of our episodes at Apple Podcasts. Our show this week is produced by BJ Fregoso, original music, production, and scoring by Adrian Anaya, original music by Danny Castillo, Kinsley Barry Quattro, Orlando Kennedy, and vocals provided by Rosella. And special thanks also to VDOT, Professor H, Jordan Dinwiddie, Nick Pop, and Lily Lynn. I'm Bima, and you've been listening to Claim Us Stories.